135 of Breaking Tape with Dodd and Barry. Barry Rose, it is time once again, my friend, to go down that road. I'm going to sound like Ron Fuller here, Bear. We're going down that road of wrestling history. We're going to go somewhere this week, Barry, that, Barry, I don't think a good podcast, I'd like to think we're a good podcast, has gone before. We are talking about the history of Montreal wrestling, my friend. What do you think about that, Bear?
Super excited, too. I was talking last week to our friend Nick Massey. And
who?
Nick,
who?
Nick, luscious Nick Massey, one of the only honest wrestling fan fest promoters. But in talking with Nick, Nick has had a lot of free time, as we all have, Jeff, over the last couple of months, for the most part, because of coronavirus, COVID-19. Nick has been home, and he went deep down the rabbit hole, and I think was telling me he watched something like 9 hours straight of Montreal wrestling, which is incredible. And then he said to me, have you ever seen it? And I said, I've seen matches here and there. And he said, holy fucking shit, this stuff is incredible. So I'm real excited to discuss Montreal wrestling today. And Jeff, do we have a guest on with us to discuss that?
I believe we in fact do. And as a matter of fact, I will point out that we have discussed one previous Montreal match. We did a match with the Rougeaus, I believe, versus the Garvins. I was thinking that Rick Martel versus Leo Burke match was Montreal, but that was Halifax, I think. So we go everywhere on this show, of course. Besides talking a little Montreal history with our friend Pat LaProde, Pat may have written a book or two, Barry. Is that correct?
Oh, Pat, I think you can count on at least one hand the amount of books, possibly even two.
All I'll say is that son of a bitch has written more books than I have, so he's pissed me off just a little bit. So we're going to be doing a deep dive into the history of Montreal wrestling. No, not just Brett, Sean, and Vince. No, we're going to be looking into stuff from the 70s. Hell, I think he takes us back into the 30s for the original Montreal screw job. This guy really knows his stuff. Pat, of course, is the author of such books as Mad Dogs, Midgets, and Screw Jobs, Sisterhood of the Squared Circle, The History of and Rise of Women's Wrestling. And he has a new book coming out on Andre the Giant. So this is a guy who is the term wrestling historian definitely could be used for Pat LaProde. And I have to tell you, folks, you're going to really like this interview. Just like Ron Fuller, you're going to sit back by the old learning tree on this one, Barry.
Yeah. And Jeff, I have to plead ignorance with this, too. Are you working with Ron, or has your
I have no heat with Ron. Ron has no heat with me because of my medical situation.
Right.
Going in and out, Ron and I have discussed that we are going to wait until I'm fully done with my my treatment before I come back. Ron has indicated that he wants me back. I'm very happy to say about that. But David Summers has been filling in and doing a great job, and I really do appreciate that. I'm trying to, as time avails me, I'm getting ready. We're recording this on Saturday. Monday, I'm going back in for round three of my chemo and starting that up again, which I wish I could say I was looking forward to that, Barry. But Barry, before we go in and talk about what else is going to be on the show, Barry, you've had an interesting week yourself, and I think the folks want to hear about that.
Well, if you mean an interesting week, like a shitty fucking week, then yes.
That's kind of what I meant, yeah.
You'd be absolutely correct. I was officially furloughed this past week, and there had been rumors really since the beginning of the coronavirus, which probably goes back to the middle of March, that this could happen to us. And if you don't know, I work for a company that specializes in electronic reservations for dine-in restaurants, meaning if you want to go out to a nice restaurant and you want to make a reservation via your phone or the computer, you could get online. And that was the company I worked for. Of course, there's been really no dine-in restaurants for the last 6 to 8 weeks. And my company, to their credit, kept all of us employed. As this past week, we kind of got word that there was going to be two rounds. One were going to be terminations, layoffs. The others were going to be furloughs. And there were over 400 employees, and I was one of the furloughs. Because at the end of the day, Jeff, if you sell to restaurants electronic reservations and nobody's taking electronic reservations, you're kind of useless. And I get it. So after 8.5 years of being with the company, they furloughed me. They're still taking care of our benefits. I have nothing but the highest respect. There's no bitterness. A little scared at my age, I guess, to be out of work and to be on
65, is it, Barry?
Yeah, almost 66. I'm okay. Almost there. So it's a little frightening. But I've also, you know, you've known me for years, Jeff. We go back 30 years. And in that time, I've lost both of my parents. I've had relationships dissolve. you know, I've lost job, whatever it is. And I've always bounced back stronger. So I've always been positive. I truly believe that whatever situation I end up with, you know, once the world gets back to some sort of normalcy, that I'll be in as good, if not better, position than I currently am. Well, that's a given. But then I was maybe even a year ago or 6 months ago. And whether it's with my company, and I hope it is, or somebody else, I just know that, you know, things will be better for me. But I got to say, Jeff, we talk every week and we're 136 episodes. 135 through weddings, through, you know, obviously your cancer, recording episodes in the hospital, which honestly, that right there should be a t-shirt. You know, fuck you. I recorded an episode in the hospital.
You don't see McAdam doing that. No.
You don't see anybody doing it. I don't care who you are. It's, you know, there's guys who are professional broadcasters. Not saying we aren't, Jeff, but there are guys who are professional broadcasters that make millions of dollars or hundreds of thousands of dollars per year that didn't do what you did. For 1 second, Howard Stern, and I listened to Howard Stern, took off a week or two because he wouldn't do what you did. And instead of doing it, they set up some other system via Zoom and whatever. He could have fucking called in and done a show, but he didn't, Jeff. You're in a hospital bed and you did. And honestly, that right there, there are two things about you that I truly find admirable. Only two, Jeff. One would be the fact that you worked a job for over 30 years. Really, as long as most of our listeners have been alive, you went to work and did your job. The second is you recorded two fucking episodes in a hospital bed hooked up to IVs. You know what? You can do a mic drop on that, Jeff. If anybody deserves it, you deserve it on that. So
I just don't like the fact that you've now revealed to the fans that we don't make millions of dollars here working for the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. Yeah. Key is a be a zabe on that because now Brian Last is, you know, out there. So besides our look at Montreal Wrestling, we're also going to be looking very also affected by the old Corona, COVID, whatever the fuck you call it, the state of the buffet industry, because I know you love a good food talk, Barry. We're going to be talking about what's going to happen to the folks at Golden Corral and Shoney's. And Barry is going to be offering up his top five buffets he's ever been to.
Yeah, and that's exciting to me. I did read an article, Jeff. I still believe that for the most part, I think that buffets, I think self-serve buffets are going to be a thing of the past, at least for the next couple of years. And I think that the general salad bar buffet has to go away. I went to a Mission Barbecue the other day, and I didn't even think about this. And I went to Mission Barbecue, and I placed my order ahead of time. I put the mask on, and I went in. You can still go in to pick up your food. You can't dine in. But with Mission, they sell you the cup, and the proceeds of the cup benefit like the USO or vets in general. And I went in with my cup that I had purchased, and you can now no longer fill up your own beverage. So that's another thing. Think of how many restaurants, quick serve, you know, Burger King, McDonald's, Taco Bell, where you go in, you get your cup and you go back and refill your own beverage. I believe that's going to go away as well. So we're going to see a lot of changes to the food and beverage industry over the next 6 months to 2 or 3 years. And it's going to be a big adjustment period for all of us. But Jeff, one thing I want to touch on before we get to our buffet talk, this past week has been monumental for you in a lot of ways because you have really started digging into regular food again.
Yes, I'm happy to say my appetite is slowly, slowly beginning to return. I had, you know, I mentioned it before. When you come out of one of your rounds of treatment, what happens is they give you a shot the day after you leave the hospital. I believe it's called Lunesta or Neulasta, something like that. And it basically makes you feel like shit. And my sister had warned me about it. She said it's the equivalent of getting a really bad cold or flu. So I went in, I believe, a week ago this past Thursday. And, you know, I hadn't been eating. My wife was extremely concerned about me. I'll give you an example of what I would have. I would have get up in the morning. I have a very limited palate because cancer and the chemo treatment affects everything with your taste and all that. I've discussed that previously. So like if I have a cup of peaches in the morning, and, you know, maybe half a cup of fruit juice or something like that, that's pretty good for me. And my wife would come home. What have you had to eat today? Well, that was about it. And so naturally, the weight is flying off me. I was down about 65 pounds. then my wife would want to make something for dinner. And depending on what she would make, I would either be willing to, you know, I would try to eat it. And, you know, I would have an appointment with Mr. Porridgeon, or I could slowly, like something like soup, I could slowly start to eat. And when I was in the hospital for the last round, I began eating some vegetable soup. And the vegetable soup was something that I was accepting. It's very strange because like chicken noodle soup, how much more basic can you get than that? I wasn't doing so well with, but the vegetable soup I was doing okay with. So I got home and I told my wife, I said, oh, why don't you try something like that? How about beef and barley soup, which is pretty basic stuff. And sure. I was accepting that, and that I was being able to tolerate. And so as I was tolerating it more, and it's really very strange. And, you know, I've told you this before we recorded, I can have something like beef and barley soup and it's no problem. My wife made Rice Krispie treats. I took one bite and I said, nope, this ain't going to work. But happily, I'm here to say that the other night, my wife went out and got some shrimp scampi. I was able to tolerate that. She made spaghetti for me last night. Was able to tolerate that. So, you know, slowly but surely, my taste buds are returning. However, I'm going back in for another round. I don't know if that means they're about to exit stage left again until I get out. We will soon find out. But
well, Jeff, I have a question too to ask. So with your increased appetite, and you are eating foods too that really aren't gentle on the stomach. We mentioned the shrimp scampi. I know you had Taco Bell this week, and you have had some other stuff that even me with a decent stomach, you could feel it. But was there anything that you would attribute to maybe spurring on your appetite?
Yes. As a matter of fact, thank you for reminding me about that. So when we're visiting the doctor, and I'm at the point where we had an appointment and my wife really brought me in because she was so worried about my appetite. And so my wife says to the doctor, you know, is there anything you can give him to spur his appetite? Oh, yeah, no, there's nothing we can give him. Which, as my wife said, she's like, I really wish you would have done that when he first started. But there's a liquid. I don't know what it's called. But it's something that they give to AIDS patients who have, of course, lost their appetite. It's, you know, you take it. It's about the size of taking a shot of like cough syrup or something like that. And I don't know what it's done, but it's certainly spurred my appetite. And I'm certainly very happy about that. I've had enough peaches to last me for the next 10 years, I think.
Jeff, before we get to the buffet, I've got an article that I just want to tell you about. And when we're done, you got to Google this. You're going to love this article, too. This appeared in the Toronto Sun over the last few days. Study links vegetarian and veganism diets to increase likelihood of depression.
We know any vegans on our Facebook group, Breaking Kayfabe with Bowden and Barry?
I doubt that. I doubt that.
I don't think we do. Highly.
But you know what? That makes a lot of sense to me because I've had this debate with a lot of my wife is a vegetarian. She's not a vegan, but she's a vegetarian. Doesn't appear to be depressed, but you know, who knows at this stage, married to me for 22 years. But at the same time, too, I couldn't imagine. I like vegetables. I like salads, but I couldn't imagine not being able to have meat. I mean, I've got a ribeye. I've got a pound and a half ribeye that I'm grilling tonight for dinner. So, and I'm super excited about that too, Jeff. But you know, my wife lives on veggie burgers and spinach and broccoli, and I've got zero desire. But I think that makes sense. I think to me, you're missing certain nutrients and proteins that you're going to get in meat, in red meat. So yeah,
my wife says she says, I will know that you're officially back to full strength once you're able to tolerate the barbecue. So,
and she's right. And Sweet Lou checking in with, and this makes a lot of sense, actually. That may certainly explain the sour temperament that Austin Aries has. Boy, that's as accurate as could possibly be. Is there a guy out there with as much talent as Austin Aries had or has that has completely fallen off the radar because he's such a raging fucking asshole?
He's got to be top three. It's a short list.
And I'll tell you this. This is not a work on this guy's part. I met him with my son at a TNA fan fest deal. TNA was great years ago, Jeff, because you would buy a ticket to the show and for an additional fee of like $40, you would get to go in before everybody else, meet all the wrestlers, get autographs and take photos. So we did that and we met everybody. Kurt Angle, really friendly. The heels were generally all friendly. There was one asshole in the group, and guess who it was? It was Austin Aries. And he wasn't working the gimmick of being a heel. He's a legitimate 100% asshole.
Well, I can tell you who's not an asshole.
Who's that?
That's Pat LaPrade, who is going to tell us a little bit about the history of Montreal wrestling And so, Barry, I tell you what, why don't we go to our discussion with Pat LaPrade, well-known author, journalist, historian. Okay, Barry, we are joined by, it says here, pro wrestling historian, Pat LaPrade, and we're going to talk a little Montreal wrestling. Pat, how are you doing today, my man?
Very good. Very good. Yourself?
We welcome you to our show. Barry and I want to talk a little Dino Bravo. We want to talk a little Montreal wrestling history. And we know that you're one of the go-to men when it comes to that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I've been a fan since I was 6 years old, and I've been, you know, writing a lot on Montreal wrestling over the past decade or so. So I know quite a bit.
Well, and Barry, before we get into this, I should say I'm a little jealous because I've only written 2 books. This guy, this son of a bitch, written 3. He's going on 4 coming out. You know, I'm a little jealous, Barry. What can I tell you?
He's got, you look at the resume, you know, and knowing Pat, and knowing the history of Pat, you know, he grew up wanting to be a sports journalist. And I think one of the definitive books on any territory is the book that he wrote on Montreal. It's called Mad Dogs, Midgets, and Screwjobs, The Untold Story of How Montreal Shaped the World of Wrestling. But he's also written some other books, as you just mentioned, Jeff. The Eighth Wonder of the World, The True Story of Andre the Giant, Mad Dog, The Maurice Vachon Story, Sisterhood of the Squared Circle, The History and Rise of Women's Wrestling. And his partner in crime for a lot of these books, Jeff, is somebody that we both know, is Bertrand Hébert.
Yes, that name, it rings a bell. I'm having a flashback to Toulouse, Florida, Barry.
Yes. And Pat, I don't know if you were aware, but we had a fan fest. It was about a year and a half ago. I believe it was our 4th CWF Legends Fan Fest. And one of our headliners was Pat Patterson. So he and Bertrand, I believe, had gotten off a cruise ship. It might have even been the Jericho cruise.
It was.
And, yeah. And Bertrand and Pat spent 3 days with us down in Tampa. And I got to say, we got more stories out of the time with Bertrand and Pat at one of the local bars. It was the International Beer Garden that we're still talking about almost 2 years later. Isn't that right, Jeff?
Can we have your credit card? Because we need to run your credit card to it. Yeah. 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 They tried to work a worker, Pat, and it didn't go over so well with Mr. Patterson.
Oh no, Pat is a tough worker in those situations. I've been there myself, but I got to say that I'm really impressed by your research, because not a lot of podcasts approached me saying that, you know, I wanted to be a sports journalist when I was a kid. So kudos on that. Yep.
Barry is the king of research.
But I was going to say, Jeff, that's the first time anybody's ever referred to us as professional either, which you got to love.
That's true.
Yeah. So we'll take it and run with it.
Exactly. What we want to do with Pat today, of course, recently we had the Dark Side of the Ring episode about Dino Bravo, and Pat is very familiar with that story. And we want to discuss that with him. However, before we get to that, Pat, what I thought we could do, much like we recently did with George Shire and the AWA, is give our listeners a little background on Montreal and the history of Montreal wrestling. And in more particular, when I first started getting the wrestling magazines, it was in the early 70s, and Montreal was one of the real hot spots of the pro wrestling world. And as a young fan, of course, I didn't know it at the time, but there was a wrestling war going on in the early 70s between, I believe, the Rougeaus and the Vachons, correct?
Yes.
So could we start from that point? Because that's the early 70s. We won't go back too far. And just tell us how the war started, where we, you know, what took us there, and what happened afterwards.
The war actually started when Yvon Robert, who was probably, and still is to this day, the most popular wrestler to ever live here, his son wanted to get into pro wrestling, and Yvon Robert had a falling out with Johnny Rougeau a few years before that. Robert didn't want to send his son to work for Johnny's promotion. So Johnny's promotion started in the mid 1960s. So he went down to Minneapolis and met with Mad Dog Vachon, and tried to convince Maurice to come back to Montreal and be, you know, once and for all, it's, you know, his own promoter. Because, you know, Maurice always wanted to make it in his own province. And, you know, unfortunately, it was not possible for him. That's why he went to the U.S., to the United States to do that. So he offered him to come back. At the same time, there was also Edouard Carpentier, the late, great Edouard Carpentier, who was more, he was doing more of a commentary job, you know, was doing commentary on Rougeau's broadcast than wrestling. And he thought that he still could wrestle a lot. So he wasn't too happy with the way he was utilized with the Rougeau promotion. So Yvonne Robert knew about this as well. So we approached Carpentier. And, you know, with some other partners, Grand Prix Wrestling was created to give a position to Johnny Rougeau and his promotion.
I don't mean to interrupt you. What yes. level was Johnny Rougeau at as far as, like, you know, you said that you had Carpentier, you had Yvonne Robert. Like, how would Rougeau compare popularity-wise to, one, you know, either one of those two guys or even to Mad Dog Vachon?
Oh, I mean, it was way more popular than Vachon at the time because Vachon barely had wrestled in Montreal during those days. And he certainly not since, you know, he became a big name in the U.S. So I would say that Johnny Rougeau was probably second or third most popular wrestler of all time at that point in time, behind Robert. And perhaps in front of Carpentier or just behind him. So he was one of the top guys. He had started back in the 1950s, but he actually stopped and came back when he opened up his own promotion. But in the meantime, he had opened a club here in Montreal, and it was, you know, so popular. So he was known not only by wrestling fans, but he was known by everyone in the province of Quebec because he was, you know, a star. You know, you could see him on TV doing interviews. You had the bar, you had the club. So, I mean, he was all over the place. So
he was a man about town.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Definitely. And I mean, so Johnny opened his promotion in the mid 60s. So he ran by himself for 5 or 6 years. And then in 1971, Grand Prix Wrestling started. And soon enough, the brother of Mad Dog, Paul the Butcher Vachon, who was there from the get-go but wasn't one of the associates, someone wanted to sell his shares. So Paul bought them, and he soon became the promoter for Grand Prix Wrestling. And to me, that changed everything because the promoter in Montreal couldn't wrestle. That's why Johnny Rougeau wasn't the promoter on the Ethic Commission's license. Because the Athletic Commission didn't allow the promoters to wrestle. So Johnny was the biggest star of his promotion. He needed to wrestle at the Montreal Forum, which was, you know, the biggest venue at the time. So he had somebody else. He had Bob Legs Langevin to be the promoter. So the same thing happened with Grand Prix Wrestling. Mad Dog Vachon and Carpentier were to be the big stars. So Paul Vachon took the promoter spot, so he couldn't wrestle in Montreal. But Paul became so good at being a promoter that I believe it helped a lot Grand Prix Wrestling at the time.
One of the big After magazines that I remember as a kid was the first time, and this would have been around 71, 72, the first time that Andre faced off with Don Leo Jonathan.
Yeah. I mean, so what happened there is that Andre came, the promotion opened up in the spring of 1971, and they were doing their weekly shows at the Verdun Auditorium, and the Rougeau's promotion, All-Star Wrestling, were doing theirs at the Paul Sauvé Arena. So every, you know, both promotions had their own, you know, weekly venue, but they were both competing for the Montreal Forum. So Grand Prix Wrestling in June 1st of 1971, that's when Andre started in North America. So that was in Verdun at the auditorium. So that was the very first time that he wrestled in Montreal and in North America. But the other key to Grand Prix Wrestling success was the contacts that both Vachons had over the years. You know, they could bring anyone they wanted from the territories, south of the border, because they knew everyone. And Maurice and Paul were liked by, you know, most in the business. So that was a big help for them as well. Johnny was more linked to New York, but he didn't have the same contacts that the Vachons had at the time. So, I mean, the war was pretty much what you saw 20 years later between WWF and WCW. They were competing for the same fans, the same venues. They both had TVs. I mean, both shows, actually, All-Star Wrestling were on Saturday afternoon, and Drop Your Wrestling were on Sunday mornings at 11 a.m., and both shows drew a million viewers. But, I mean, they were competing for fans, for the venue. They were competing for the same talent. So soon enough, you had the Leduc brothers, Joe and Paul Leduc, who transferred to Grand Prix. Dino Bravo and Gino Brito transferred to Grand Prix because Grand Prix was paying more than Johnny. Johnny wasn't known to be... Someone once explained to me that Johnny paid in the dark. So I mean, you know, I remember Gino Brito telling me that all he asked from Johnny was to give him a raise, and Johnny didn't want to. He didn't even want Johnny to match the payoff that Grand Prix was going to give him. He just wanted a raise, and Johnny didn't want to. So he switched to Grand Prix. So there's a bunch of reasons why Grand Prix quickly established himself. And, you know, in 1972, the big feud, there was actually two big feuds going on at the same time. You had Andre and Don Leo Jonathan, who had a series of three matches between May and September 1972 that drew approximately 16,000 for the first one, 20,000 for the second one, and 12,000 for the third one. But at the same time, you had probably the best rivalry in the history of pro wrestling in the province of Quebec between the Vachon brothers and the Leduc brothers. But that feud couldn't be in Montreal, because remember, Paul Vachon couldn't wrestle in Montreal.
No,
so
right.
That feud sold out Quebec City Coliseum, which was the second biggest arena in the province, you know. They could draw 15, 16,000 there, and they packed it many times. But
okay,
they had,
hold on.
Yes.
You're rolling. You're rolling.
I know. Bring it on, Pat. Bring it on. I'm sitting here. I've got 50 questions for you. So,
okay. My first question is,
yes,
did each promotion have like their fans that are like loyal to the promotion, or the fans just kind of like, hey, we're loving all of it? Or was it like, you know, where you have WWE fans and you had WCW fans, or were the people in the Montreal and Quebec area just loving the fact they were having all this great wrestling?
I think that might be different than WWF and WCW. I think fans were into Quebec wrestling as a whole and not necessarily being fans of one promotion or the other. So that was my understanding. Yeah.
Okay. And the second question, and then I'll give it to Barry because I know he said he's got questions. The Jonathan Andre feud, all the numbers, did they ever go to Jerry Park, or was it strictly in the arena?
Strictly in the arena, strictly at the Montreal Forum, because the Jerry Park wasn't even used before All-Star Wrestling did in July of 1972. And Grand Prix Wrestling had its comeback there in July of 1973. So it was only in the at the Montreal Forum.
Okay, Barry, your turn.
Gotcha. So you mentioned Yvon Robert earlier and his son wanting to get into the business. Now, we saw Yvon Robert Jr., if I'm correct, that was his name. He was in Florida in the early 70s. I want to say it was 1973 as Bobby Brunel.
Yep.
And he didn't strike me as a guy that was going to be setting the world on fire. So was this a case, obviously, a father protecting his son, but what kind of a talent was Yvon Robert Jr.?
Well, you know, he was more limited in his skills. He didn't have the charisma that his father had. But I mean, you know, it's like in anything, right? When you're the son of a legend, it's not always easy on you. So Yvon Jr. never became close to what his father had become. But at the time, you know, his father wanted him to, he wanted to be in the business. And, you know, his father just didn't want to send him to Johnny Rougeau. But, I mean, Yvon had an MBA. So he was a very, very smart guy in a world where usually guys don't have MBAs. So he was one of the, when his father passed the promotion, like I said, opened up in the spring of 1971. But on July 12, 1971, Yvonne Robert passed away from, I think, 8 heart attacks. So, I mean, he really had heart problems, and he passed away in July of 71. So his son, Yvonne Jr., took his part of the shares of Grand Prix Wrestling. So he became owner with the Vachons and with Carpentier. And that led to a feud within the a war within the organization. You had the Vachon brothers on one side, and you had Carpentier and Yvonne Jr. on the other side. And to the point that, you know, Jr. and Carpentier didn't think that the Ledoux would be a good idea to bring in. And the Vachons, Maurice told them, well, if you don't know what to do with them, give it to them. Give them to me, and I know what to do with them. And they break records all over the province of Quebec. But the war was so intense within the organization that when the cities that Carpentier and Jr. were running didn't do well, the Vachons were happy about it. And when the cities that the Vachons were running weren't doing well, Carpentier was happy about it. So, but it was all the same money, right? So that didn't help. And, you know, that's the reason why Grand Prix Wrestling didn't last forever. And at the end of that war, the Rougeaus had won it.
Wow. Well, wasn't Carpentier getting towards the end, though, at the early 70s?
He's past
his prime.
He was past his prime because, I mean, he started here in Montreal in 1956, if I'm not mistaken. And, he was on fire right from the get-go. He sold out. He didn't sell out, but, I mean, he drew more than 20,000 people, I think, two or three times in his first summer here. He came in April of 56. I want to say 56. It might be 57, but I think it's 56 on top of my head like this. And 3 months later, he drew more than 20,000 people on three different occasions at the Delormier Stadium Park, where the Montreal Royals were playing. The Montreal Royals were the team that Jackie Robinson had played for. So that was their the stadium that Eddie Quinn was doing shows during the summer. So, I mean, Carpentier was on fire when he first came in. But yeah, you know, that was 15 years later. So, but Carpentier was still considered as a big star and could still, you know, draw a lot of people. And, you know, after Grand Prix, he kept on going. And even when international wrestling started in 1980, he wrestled Hulk Hogan here. So, wow. But by the 80s, he was definitely, you know, close to the end of his active career. But in the early 70s, he could still go.
Yeah. What I liked about your book, too, and that, again, that's another fascinating story. But what I liked about your book was the wealth of knowledge of stuff that I had never heard or read about previously. And I think if you talk to the modern professional wrestling fan right now and you say the word Montreal, two words are going to populate, and that's going to be screw job, which may even be one word. Jeff, is that one word?
Thank you, right. Mr. Grammar.
Yeah, right. So the Montreal screw job. Here's what I learned, though, in reading this amazing book. The famous Montreal screw job that we know, which was Bret Hart, Shawn Michaels, Vince McMahon, was not the first. There was a Montreal screw job that occurred in the 1930s. Pat, tell us about that.
Yeah, and that was the idea behind the title of the book. There were, you know, everybody knows about Mad Dog Vachon, but there was more than one Mad Dog in Quebec. You had other wrestlers nicknamed Mad Dog. And you know, midget wrestling started in Montreal, and there were so many midget wrestlers coming from the province of Quebec. And the screw job was the same thing. You know, everybody knows about the one in 1997, but everybody had forgotten about the one from the early 1930s. So in 1931, it was between Henri de Glane and Strangler Lewis here in Montreal, where during the match, at one point, de Glane had shown to the referee that his opponent had bit him on the arm. And Lewis got disqualified for it. And that's how de Glane won the title. But in reality, it was the bite marks that was given to him by his cornerman during in between falls. So that was a screw job And the man behind the screw job was actually the promoter, Paul Bosser, who wanted to get that. You know, there was all kind of power plays, you know, at the time between group of promoters. And it was Paul Bosser who wanted to get the title back or the so-called world title back to its own organization. So that happened in Montreal. So it's funny because in the Dark Side of the Ring series about the Montreal Screwjob, you got Jim Cornette, who knew about that and who told Vince McMahon about that, you know, screwjob from back in the day. And, you know, we learned in the documentary that it's actually Cornette who gave McMahon the idea of doing a screwjob. It wasn't the first screwjob. And it's funny because pretty much the same thing happened to this one, in the sense that years, some historians are critical of it being really a screw job and not being a work. And the same thing happened with the one with Brett and Sean, you know, where you still have people to this day saying that it was all a work. So, you know, when it's easy to say that when you look at, you know, at what happened 20 years after the facts, but both were actual screw jobs.
So you just brought up something that I think is pretty interesting that I did not know about. And I want to get back to the Andre Don Leo Jonathan program. Yes. And ask you some questions about that. But midget wrestling starts in Montreal.
Yep.
And of course, that brings to mind two names that seemingly were around midget wrestling forever that I believe both are from Quebec. And that's Sky Lolo and my all-time favorite midget name. And Barry, I know you love this one, Little Beaver.
Oh, Little Beaver. Yeah.
Yeah, of course. It was a small-time promoter here at the end of the 1940s who promoted the very first midget wrestling match. And on that show, you had a guy by the name of Jack Britton. Jack Britton was a wrestler, and he saw that match, and he thought that, you know, midget wrestling would be really popular if it was, you know, promoted properly and everything. So he kind of took that under his wing, and he became, you know, the only midget wrestling promoter, and he was booking midget wrestlers from all over the world. And Jack Britton is actually Gino Brito's father. So that's how Gino got started in the business. He was driving for midget wrestlers throughout North America, getting a few pennies per miles. And, you know, that's how he started and, you know, doing prelim match on the same card that the midget were going to be the attraction. So a lot of midget wrestlers came from the province of Quebec because of that. But, you know, obviously Little Beaver and Sky Lolo probably became the most known of the faction. But even in the 1990s, you had Tiger Jackson, who's a guy from the province of Quebec, South Shore of Montreal, who was playing Dink with Donk the Clown in the WWF. So there's a long and rich history of midget wrestling here in Montreal.
Wow. So another question I wanted to ask, too, and I got to say, I truly do love your book, and I think it is...
thank you.
I think it's one of the best books ever written on the history of professional wrestling, certainly on a territory or a region. But I remember reading the book. What I like about your book, and I think Jeff and I have discussed this previously, when you read great art and you get moved, you know it's great art. I read your book and I was moved. I don't know if I was moved in the way that a lot of people are, but you tell a story about Bob Legs Langevin and an injury to his groin. And I got to admit, I'm reading this story and all of a sudden I'm crossing my legs. I'm sweating a little bit and I'm getting all nervous. Would you clue the people in on what happened to this guy? He had this injury, Jeff. I don't know if you remember this. And then he had some unfortunate injuries throughout his career. He's had terrible luck, obviously. But tell us about Bob. He was a famous
I never like hearing a story that begins with groin and unfortunate injury. So Pat, go ahead and tell us.
Yeah. I mean, Bob Langevin, he was working in the early 1930s and, you know, trying to make a living out of it. He had wrestled in England. He had wrestled, you know, in Canada, in Montreal, in the U.S. as well. And I think it was in the mid-30s that a fan hit Langevin's genitals with an electric cord because he was a heel. So he was kind of attacked by that fan. with an electric cord to the genitals. And he was left impotent at the age of 21.
Each.
So
I got to go lay down. Yeah, I got to lay down now. This is brutal. But then he had issues later in life, right?
Yeah, he had colon cancer surgery in the mid-1960s. He ended up passing away at a fairly old age. You know, he was 91 when he finally passed away. So, I mean, he had a lot of unfortunate events, but in his life. But you know, still he lived a pretty long life, and he was involved in professional wrestling all of his life. Like I said, he was the promoter for Johnny Russo on the license. I remember there's a story there. One of my dad's friends was a pharmacist who was very connected with the world of boxing and wrestling. I learned years later that he was one of the owners of All-Star Wrestling with the Russo family. So back in the 1980s, early 1990s, every time I wanted to go see the matches at the Montreal Forum, my dad would call his friend. And sure enough, I got a pair of tickets waiting for me at the Montreal Forum. So the tickets were always at the media, you know, where media could pick up their passes and everything. And there was Bob Langevin sitting there, and he was the one distributing tickets, you know, kind of, you know, special tickets or media passes or that kind of stuff. So I knew of Bob Langevin because of that, you know, years before I even started reading about who Bob Langevin was, you know, but I knew him by name because he was the guy that I needed to go and see to get tickets. So he was even recognized by the WWF in 1995 when they did their very last wrestling show at the Montreal Forum before it closed and it became the Molson Center and then the Bell Center. So wrestling was all his life, was all of his life. But, you know, he had some unfortunate accidents throughout his life. Yeah.
Wow. Okay, if I could real quick get back to the Don Leo Jonathan Andre program. You said there were three big matches. Could you give me a little background? Because like I said, that's when I first started getting into the wrestling magazines as a kid. Tell us how that program was set up. Obviously, it was a huge, huge deal.
Yeah, it was set up first when Carpentier was wrestling Don Leo Jonathan, and Andre the Giant came to help him. And so that's how they got started between Andre and Jonathan. Because, you know, in Montreal, if you want to be a successful babyface in Montreal, you need to speak French. You know, besides Hulk Hogan, that's probably the exception that made the rule. But, you know, all the other big time babyfaces were speaking French. That's what is different about the province of Quebec than the other provinces in Canada. So either you had to be from the province of Quebec or from France. So guys like Henri Deglan, guys like Carpentier, and obviously Andre were really, really over in Montreal because of that. So it just made sense that Andre and Carpentier would be linked, you know, at one point or another in Grand Prix Wrestling. So Carpentier and Jonathan are fighting for the title that Carpentier had. And Andre came and helped Carpentier and disqualifying him by the same token. So that didn't really fit with Jonathan because in his storyline, Jonathan didn't win the title because of that. He won the match, but not the title. So that started the feud between Jonathan and Andre. And the very first match on May 31st, 1972, was dubbed the match of the century. It was kind of an homage to the fight of the century between Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier that happened.
They did a tail of the tape and all that kind of stuff with the heights and weights and everything.
Exactly, exactly. So, you know, it was sold as, you know, the biggest opponent that Andre could actually face. Jonathan hadn't wrestled in Montreal since the 1950s. So, you know, he was coming back to the territory at the time, and he was just the perfect challenger for Andre. I remember him telling me that he was working in the Maritimes here in Canada when Paul Vachon called him and asked him, you know, they needed somebody tall who could actually work, and Jonathan was the perfect fit for that. So the first match drew a very good crowd, but the rematch was even better because it drew 20,000+ people. And the matches were, that's when you saw Andre, a lot of Andre's booking here in Montreal was him starting to be angry at the heel or at the referee or something, and then just acting completely wild. So on one of those two matches, Andre, I believe it was on, you know, at the end of the first one, Andre just hit pile drivers on Jonathan to the point that he was just disqualified because, you know, something just made him flip. So that was a lot of Andre's booking here. So he actually lost the match, but didn't take the fall. So that was, you know, the way that Paul Vachon had to protect Andre and not making him win all the time. But Montreal was really, you're talking about the Jonathan program, is really what made Andre known throughout Canada and throughout the U.S. That's how Vince Sr. first heard of Andre. But the booking of Andre here in Montreal was completely different than what he used to be in France. And that's a lot because of Paul Vachon. Paul Vachon introduced Andre to battle royals, to handicap matches. He tried to make him work more like a giant and less like a European style, like he was still performing in Paris, you know, before he came over here. So a lot of that really was established here in Montreal.
And of course, you know, back when Andre was younger, a lot of people that are listeners of this podcast may remember Andre as the, you know, against Hogan when he was slower and had put on a lot of weight, was having back problems. When he was younger, boy, he could really go.
Oh, he could go. He could go. I mean, if you go on Andre the Giant's page on YouTube, you'll find matches he was having in France back in the mid-60s, the mid to late 60s. And I mean, he could go 30, 40 minutes sometimes. He was, you know, working on the mat, doing scientific wrestling, submission holds, body scissors, and all that. And even to the late 1970s, there's a match on YouTube between him and Harley Race from Houston. I believe it was 78 or 79. And yeah, it's a very, very good 20, 25 minute match. You know, something that, like you said, you know, fans who only saw him after 1984 couldn't even, you know, think that Andre could work like this.
So what was the rubber match, the third match between Jonathan and Andre? What happened?
Oh, I mean, that's the match that didn't work as much because not only Grand Prix realized that Andre had to be used as an attraction. He had spent the summer in Montreal working all over, I mean, in Montreal, in the province of Quebec. So he had worked, you know, all over the province. And he was working more regularly in Montreal. So when the time came of that third match, they only drew 12,000 people. I mean, which is a big drop from 20,000 people. So I think that's when really Paul Vachon and Grand Prix realized that they had to use Andre differently and to, you know, spare his appearance here in Montreal. And that's something that Vince McMahon Sr. really, really did and understood when he started booking Andre 6 months later in March of 1973. It's just a shame, guys, that none of those matches, any footage of those matches still exists today. That's just unfortunate because, you know, I would have liked to see those matches. So we just have, you know, whatever the newspapers reported at the time. But it was definitely the feud that made Andre in North America.
You know, one of the things about Montreal, too, is it was such a great breeding ground for professional wrestling going back to the 30s and continuing decades later. But you look at the long list of guys that were either Montreal or the province of Quebec, but guys like Rene Goulet and one of my personal favorites, Tarzan Tyler. And I should say, too, both of those guys spent a lot of time in the state of Florida. Yeah. We saw Rene Goulet going back to the early 70s. 10 years later, he's still a top contender in the state and holding titles. But Tarzan Tyler was one of those guys that I got to see when I was a young kid. And I want to say it was 1971, right when I started going to wrestling. And he was larger than life in a lot of ways. Give me a really good Tarzan Tyler story.
Yeah, I just want to point out something. You're saying that Montreal wrestling going back to the 1930s. I mean, even if you look before that, at the beginning of the 20th century, Frank Gotch and George Eichenschmidt wrestled in Montreal back in the early 1900s. So, I mean, the history goes back a long way. To go back to your question, Tarzan Tyler, I mean, I only knew him from his manager role he had when international wrestling in the 80s. But I remember when one of the first times that I spoke with Jerry Briscoe, I think it was in Waterloo, Iowa, for the Tragus and Tez Hall of Fame there. And I was asking him about Tarzan Tyler. And he told me that back in the day in Florida with Eddie Graham as the promoter, Eddie had a rule, you know, you had to be dressed a certain way when you were coming to the shows. There was a dress code and everybody was following it, everybody but Tarzan Tyler. And he was the only one who could get away with it. So Tarzan, everybody was like very well dressed. And Tarzan and Jerry, it's funny because Jerry looks at me and said, well, he was pretty much, you know, like you, you know, very French, Quebec kind of way to dress, which was, and I remember looking at myself and I had flip-flops, I had a pair of Bermudas and I had a t-shirt on. And I was like, he was dressed like this? He said, yeah. But I mean, that wasn't the dress code. And no, it wasn't. But, you know, Tarzan was the only one that Eddie Graham was learning dress like this. So everybody was dressed up properly, but Tarzan would come in with his flip-flops, his Bermuda shorts and his t-shirt on and didn't give a crap. And that's, you know, the reputation that Tarzan had. He didn't give a damn about those things. And, you know, for, you know, a reason or another, promoters were letting him fly with this, you know, but unfortunately, you know, he passed away, as you must know, in a terrible car accident on Christmas Eve, 1985, along with another wrestler, Pierre Mad Dog Lefevre, and referee Adrien Desbois. They were coming back from a show in northern Quebec, and someone, you know, fell asleep on the wheel, and they hit a big truck on the other side of the road, and, you know, the three of them were killed instantly. So it was a big blow for international wrestling and for Quebec wrestling in general at the time.
Now, when he was winding up his career, he was working as a manager, which you had mentioned. Was that with the Masked Superstar?
It was with the Masked Superstar. It was also with Pierre Lefevre and Frenchy Martin as a tag team. He was also manager of King Tonga for a while, Haku in the WWF. So yeah, the, you know, a stable here. There was him and there was Eddie the Brain Creechman, who were the big two managers at the time here, you know, for international wrestling.
So let me ask you, at some point, you got the promotional war. Tell us what the result of the promotional, like, because obviously we hear of Jacques and Raymond Rougeau and, you know, other guys. So what's the result of the promotional war is the bottom line?
Well, the result was that Grand Prix Wrestling became the number one promotion in the province of Quebec between 72 and the summer of 73, when they did the big show at Jarry Park Stadium and outdrew what All-Star Wrestling did the year before. So with Mad Dog Vachon and Killer Kowalski main eventing the show, they drew a little bit more than 29,000 people, which is to this day the biggest wrestling crowd ever in the province of Quebec. But, you know, like I said, internal problems were really starting to affect the promotion. And by the end of 1973, the Vachons sold their shares of Grand Prix and left the promotion. And by the beginning of 1974, they started doing joint shows with All-Star Wrestling. The first one really, really worked. Main event was Jacques Rougeau against Don Leo Jonathan. But, you know, André wasn't in those shows and the Vachons weren't in those shows either. So it kind of missed, you know, what it's pretty much like when Vince bought WCW, but didn't bring the big stars that WCW had, you know. So it fell the same way here in 1974. And, you know, by the time those joint shows happened, All-Star Wrestling had won the war. And Grand Prix Wrestling slowly closed the following year, but All-Star Wrestling kept going till 1976 when Johnny Rougeau knew that he was losing his television and just, you know, stopped the print and closed the promotion down. But, you know, in 1972, Raymond Rougeau had started working. In 1971, I'm sorry. Ray Rougeau started working with his dad and his uncle. So, you know, he had the legacy there. And Jacques pretty much stopped. You know, he wrestled a bit in the early 1980s with his sons when Ray was working for International Wrestling, as well as Jacques and the third brother, Armand. But, I mean, the Rougeau family really became the first family of wrestling, the royal family of wrestling here in Montreal, because you had Johnny, you had Jacques, you had his three sons. You had Joanne, who was Jacques and Ray's sister, who was the promoter for WWF in the late 1990s here in Montreal, in the province of Quebec. And then you had Jacques' son, who also, the three of them at one point also wrestled. So it's a big family here in Quebec.
Wasn't there also a brother-in-law? Wasn't there a brother who wrestled that was married to one of the sisters?
Yes, Denis Gauthier was married with Joanne Rougeau, and he was Ray Rougeau's partner, tag team partner, back in the 1970s. And Denis and Joanne's son became an NHL player, Denis Gauthier Jr., for the Calgary Flames, among other teams. And one of Denis Sr. grandson from another marriage is, I want to say, New York Rangers prospect. He started in the NHL this year. He was a first-round draft choice by the Carolina Hurricanes 2 years ago. So, yeah, big hockey family link here as well.
So let me ask you, when you talked about, you alluded to some internal strife within the Grand Prix. Was that the stuff with Carpentier and the Vachons that you were referring to?
Yes.
Okay. So would you say basically that Rougeau was able to wait out the internal strife that Grand Prix had?
Yes.
Is that a fair way of putting it?
Yeah, it would be a fair way, because, I mean, I believe that if within Grand Prix they could have get along better, I'm wondering, you know, what would have happened. And it's funny because, you know, 30, 40 years later, when you talk to Ray Rougeau, he will tell you that Grand Prix wrestling was just a flash in the pan that didn't really bother them. And when you talk to Paul Vachon, he'll tell you that, you know, they dominated the scene here and that, you know, they left All-Star Wrestling into the dust. But when you look at the numbers, you can realize that, you know, Grand Prix Wrestling drew more at the Montreal Forum, drew more in Quebec City, but it didn't last long. So it's like both of them are right, you know. It's true that they really dominated the scene, and it's true that it didn't last long, you know. But if it would have been better managed internally or didn't have that war going on inside of the organization, you know, who knows? Perhaps Grand Prix Wrestling would have outlasted All-Star Wrestling.
And based on what you're telling us, hey, Barry, who knew that Butcher Vachon was a great booker, huh?
Yes, I saw Butcher a few times in Florida. But yeah, as a booker, that I never would have saw. But that's an interesting...
Oh, yeah, he was ahead of his time. He actually struck a deal because the Rougeaus didn't own their own tape, in the sense that, you know, they had a deal with a TV station here, Channel 10, but the images belonged to Channel 10. So what Paul Vachon wanted to do is to own, you know, its own tape. So he was, you know, making deals, and he quickly had a deal in place to have both an English and French television program, but he was still, you know, the owner of its own footage. So what he did is that he was sending those footage throughout Canada. So he was on television from coast to coast, just in case that, you know, if one day he wanted to, I don't know, do a show in Winnipeg or in Calgary or wherever else, well, you know, his guys would already be known and his promotion would already be known. That was unheard of, you know, that was something that not a lot, if any, promoter were actually doing at the time. So he was very creative.
He was going national before Vince Jr.
Yeah, well, like I said, he never ended up running shows outside of Quebec besides Ottawa, Ontario, and a few shows in Vermont. But, you know, he had that system in place, and he was very creative in what he was doing and the way that, you know, he wanted to present Andre the Giant. That 7'4" thing, that was Paul Vachon. That was the Vachons. It wasn't Vince Sr. It was on the very first ad, before his first match, on his very first ad, he was already billed as 7'4". So, I mean, he was a huge, huge part of the success of Grand Prix Wrestling here as a promoter.
Gotcha. So we're talking about, you know, guys like Mad Dog Vachon, and we mentioned Yvon Robert Jr. earlier, but there seemed to be a connection between Florida wrestling and Montreal, where guys would come down, maybe stay for a couple of weeks, maybe 3 weeks, something like that, and then obviously go back to Canada. Mad Dog Vachon, we saw a few times in 1973, actually got an NWA World's Heavyweight title match against Jack Briscoe in Miami Beach, which was interesting because he was not a regular down here, so this was based off of his reputation. But I want to discuss something with you because I know that Corsica Jean, Jean-Louis Roy, was a big deal in Montreal with his kayfabe brother, the Corsica brothers. How familiar with his murder are you?
Not a lot, actually. That's something that we didn't really cover in the book. Now you got me here because this is not something I'm really, really familiar with.
Yeah, and the reason I was asking too, because I saw it in your book where you referenced that he had been assassinated in 1992, but Jeff and I do, one of the things we do 3 or 4 times a year is we do an Unsolved Mysteries episode. Okay. And generally, it's not really about wrestling, but we always throw a wrestling story in there. So we threw this story in there, this probably the last 6 months to a year, and it is an unsolved mystery. They never caught his killer. And I just wondered if you had known any of the facts of this and if you had any ideas on it. But, you know, he was a guy that was really well respected within the state of Florida, Canada as well, I'm sure. And the fact that we're almost 30 years later and nobody's ever been charged with this crime it's sad.
Yeah, but I mean, in Montreal, he wasn't that much of a deal. I think that he had a much bigger career in the United States than he actually had here in Montreal. And unfortunately, that's a story that has been kind of lost, you know, with years. So I knew of him because of reading about it when, you know, I started doing research on the history of wrestling here. But he had a much better career south of the borders. And yeah, so I never really inquired on the way that he actually was assassinated, unfortunately. But there's a big link between Florida and Montreal in the sense that a lot of Quebecers go spend their winters in Florida. And that's been, you know, that is going on for years and years and years. You know, Jacques Rougeau Sr. was spending all of his winters, you know, in Florida before he first got sick and wasn't able to do so anymore. So, I mean, there's so many, just not wrestling people. I mean, people in general, you know, we call them snowbirds.
Absolutely.
We usually see him at the beach, usually wearing a thong.
Very.
and probably swearing in French, you know? So, yeah, right. we're not always proud of the way they portray us, but I mean, there's a big link between Florida. And that's why I think, you know, there's so many guys. I mean, Joe LeDuc worked Florida. Paul LeDuc worked there as well. You mentioned Pat, there's so many.
Pat, since you mentioned the name, that was going to be my next question. I wanted to talk to you because Barry and I have talked before, since Barry is Mr. CWF. We talked about the famous Dusty Rhodes turn, and everybody became a huge Dusty fan because he was such a breakout babyface at the time. But I, during that time period, was Joe LeDuc was my man. So let's talk about the legacy of Joe LeDuc and to a lesser extent, his brother, Paul. Tell us some memories of Joe LeDuc when he was working in Quebec up in Montreal and when he eventually made the move down to CWF.
Yeah, well, Joe LeDuc wasn't the same character in Montreal than he was in the United States, you know. In Montreal, he first started in the 1960s, mid to late 60s, for the Rougeau promotion, teaming with Paul LeDuc, you know, his big brother, because they were not real brothers. And, you know, he started here. He was much bigger than Paul physically, I mean. And when I was mentioning the feud between the LeDucs and the Vachons, he was the star, you know, he was the star of the team. He had become, you know, that big of a deal. He was the one getting title shots against the champion. He even beat. There's a funny story where Paul LeDuc was a weasel. Okay, that's how Paul Vachon described him. And he said he would be proud to be called like this. And when I spoke with Paul LeDuc, Vachon was right. You know, Paul LeDuc started laughing. So Paul LeDuc had his nose everywhere. You know, he was with Grand Prix and he knew everything that was still going on with All-Star Wrestling. And when he was, you know, with All-Star in the late 60s, he convinced Johnny Rougeau to drop the title to Joe LeDuc. And Johnny agreed to it, but he wanted something in return. So what the deal was is that in return, Paul would have to be married in the Montreal Forum during the Christmas show of that year. Because, you know, Paul was about to marry his girlfriend at the time. And Johnny said, well, you know, if you want Joe to win the title, well, you'll need to get married, you know, in front of the crowd at the Montreal Forum. And Paul did it, you know, for the show. So Paul, you know, was instrumental, I think, in getting Joe over here in Montreal. And they were playing that Lumberjack tag team, you know, the two brothers were Lumberjacks. But when Joe was working south of the border, he was really more, you know, aggressive, more intense. You know, that feud with Jerry Lawler in Memphis, you know, where
Joe The blood oath.
Yeah, exactly. You know, he would slice his arm with an axe. I mean, that's something that people in Montreal didn't see at all. We didn't see that version of Joe LeDuc. He was the guy as a babyface. I remember him, you know, doing comebacks like Hogan was doing, you know, so getting hit and not selling to the point that Joe was taking over the match and going to the finish. So that was the Joe LeDuc that we knew here. But we never, I mean, people that are longtime fans of Quebec wrestling, but that didn't really watch anything else, are traumatized when they see Joe LeDuc working in Memphis or, you know, other territories, because that's not how they remember him. So Jerry Lawler always said that Joe LeDuc was probably the one that he drew the most money with. He was that big dude, you know, big lumberjack gimmick. And he was just playing crazy. You know, he was just that lumberjack, crazy guy that really...
Well, and then when he was connected. In Florida, he was like a lovable lumberjack. Would it be fair, Barry?
Yeah, so like in the beginning,
big bear of a guy.
Big bear of a guy. He was a guy, he was a great baby face. That was the irony of it. And then as Jeff was just describing and discussing earlier about the heel turn, literally... At the blink of an eye, he went from this big, lovable lumberjack to this raving lunatic. It was an incredible, immediate transformation.
Yeah, well, he did turn heel here as well in Montreal in the 1980s, but that didn't last long. And unfortunately, you know, his last years weren't as good, you know, and he had a lot of addictions, and he passed away in, I think it was in 1999. So, but I mean, he is still well remembered. And the funny thing is that he is always, or not always, but often mixed up with Mad Dog Vachon. Because, you know, at one point, both were wearing beards and didn't have, you know, were bald. So in a lot of pictures, people would say, oh, look, it's Mad Dog Vachon. And I said,
That's the look that Paul had, too.
That's Joe LeDuc, you know. So so it's funny because the Vachons and the LeDucs, you had one small guy and one big guy, but the best of the two weren't the same. So in the Vachon team, Maurice was definitely the best worker, so he was a small guy. But in the LeDuc team, it was the big guy who was the big star. So whenever they were doing singles matches, it was always Joe against Mad Dog.
Our thanks again to Pat LaPrade for such a great and insightful history of wrestling in Montreal, Quebec. Pat's new book on Andre the Giant, the Eighth Wonder of the World, is available now. Pat joins us next week to discuss the Dino Bravo murder, and you never know, we could probably get some food tips out of him. Is the Walensky special all that it's cracked up to be? What's the best place in Montreal for smoked meat? And how about those Montreal bagels and poutine? We'll definitely get the scoop on poutine. Speaking about food.
Special update edition of Breaking Kayfabe with Bowder and Barry. We're recording this out of sequence because, Barry, you love to talk about food more than anybody I know. I'm sitting here chomping on a popsicle, and Barry texts me and says, let's do a quick segment on what in God's name with this friggin' COVID-19 is going to happen to buffets across the country, Barry. Tell us what you think. folks, excuse me while I enjoy a nice popsicle.
Popsicles are wonderful, Jeff. And I got to say, speaking on behalf of the entire brothership, myself, Sweet Lou Kippelman, we are thrilled that you're able to eat again. So you are enjoying a popsicle. I know, Jeff, you mentioned that you were eating pizza earlier as well as some pasta fagioli. So I stand, I applaud. I'm glad that you are able to eat. Are you able to taste the food? That's a big thing, too.
Yes. And that was part of the problem was, along with the taste, it was the texture of the food. You know, I didn't tell you this. I was speaking to Ron Fuller today and told him about it. My wife made Rice Krispie treats the other day.
Oh.
I took one bite of it and said, nope, not going to happen.
Wow. And,
you know, it no telling. You know, she made blueberry muffins a couple weeks ago. I did turn down blueberry fucking muffins. You know, and she made chocolate chip cookies. I had half of one. And, you know, because of the texture, whatever, the chemo, I couldn't do it. It kills me. I've been a fat guy my whole life. You know, it's just killing me. So now I was able to have some pasta fagioli. Of course, it's a little humorous based on where we got it from. After our interview last week with Dave Meltzer, where we were completely aghast with the fact that Dave enjoys Olive Garden. My least favorite place to get pasta fagioli is Olive Garden. So naturally, my daughter, the lovely Kelly Cohn, calls me and says, hey, I'm going to the Olive Garden. You want me to pick you up some soup? And I said, ah, what the hell? Okay. So we pick up some, she picks up some pasta fagioli, which I don't like. I don't like because it's got all the carrots in it. I don't know why. So, and every different Italian place you go to, by the way, has a different version of pasta fagioli. Have you noticed that, Barry?
Yep, you're right.
So she brings it over and I tried it last night, went down, no problem. And I had some for lunch today. My wife had gone out and got pizza at a local pizza chain. And she said, there's two small slices left. And I basically dipped my toe into the pool successfully. So I was very happy about that.
Jeff, when you posted that photo in our Facebook group, which if you're listening to this and you're not a member of the Facebook group, what are you waiting for? It's an extension of the show.
What the fuck? Come on.
Exactly. People. You posted a photo of deep dish Chicago style pizza. Was that something that you just found online? Have you ever had traditional deep dish Chicago pizza?
Finishing a popsicle. As a matter of fact, we have. When we went to Chicago a couple of years ago to see a Cubs game, and when I went up there with my sister and my late brother-in-law about 10 years ago, we both did. Now, I want to say, up there, you got your Lou Malnati's.
Yep.
You got your Giordano's. And what's the third one?
You got a place called My Pie, which I'm...
No. It's something east.
Gino's East.
Gino's East. Okay, that's what it is. That's the third. I'm sorry, Barry. That's what I was thinking of. We went to one of those three places. And, you know, because you're basically baking a pie.
Right.
There's like a 30-minute wait after you get to the table and order the damn thing. But we went to one of those three. I can't remember. And then the next time we went back, I think we went to Lou Malnati's. And I certainly will not be eating a deep dish pizza based on what's going on right now. But no, that was just something I found on the internet. And there's always a good discussion of pizza to stir up the locals on Breaking Cafe with Bowden and Barry.
Yeah, we always seem to get it. It is funny, too. There are certain things we can put up. If there's a photo of an attractive female or food, it riles up the natives every single time. So we know what people... Wrestling is the commonality that brought us all together. It's the threads that bind us all together as a family. But at the same time, the biggest reactions generally are coming from a pair of breasts or a pizza. Exactly. That's when the fights break out, too, when that shit takes place. But you said something that was sad and yet very accurate. But buffets are something that for the foreseeable future are going to be going away. And I noticed because I still go grocery shopping once a week. I wear the mask. I wear the gloves. And I go into Whole Foods. And for years, you go into a Whole Foods and their salad bar, whether it's the hot bar, the cold bar. They've got, I don't know, that article that I posted in the group today basically says common sense would tell you things like salad bars and buffets are gone until we're not talking about COVID-19 anymore or the coronavirus. So they are gone. And there were some really good points that were made there. One was somebody was very sad that buffets are going away. And I'm sad, too. The other aspect which people were posting about is that buffets really are a bastion for all types of things that are disgusting. Because the truth is, you could have hundreds of people just going, unless they're sneeze guards, which I think is the law, that you've got to have that plastic guard over the food. It's still not stopping people from sneezing, coughing, whatever it might be that's going to get in there. And then there's all kinds of videos that pop up on the internet where people will go to a buffet and they'll stick their hands right in to grab something and somebody else is right there to videotape it. So they really are disgusting. But that being said, Jeff, there are some buffets that I'm going to miss, and I've got some really good memories of buffets. So I'm a little disheartened by it, but I also understand it. So when I saw that, I reached out to Jeff and I said, hey, are there buffets that stand out to you, buffets that you've been to, probably breakfast buffets, Jeff, which I know that you're a fan of.
Wait a
minute. And you said, yeah, why don't we do something? And that's it. So we are recording this out of sequence. And Jeff, I'll start off with my number five buffet of all time. It is an Indian buffet at a restaurant local to Philadelphia. It's my only Indian buffet on the list. It's called Sitar, which I believe is that string instrument that Ravi Shankar used to play along with the Beatles. But Sitar, India, which may also be a city in India, but it's really good. We've got a lot of Indian buffets here. A lot of them are mediocre at best. The common practice with a lot of Indian buffets is to take whatever was left the night before that we didn't sell and throw it out on a buffet. And so there are good and bad. Sitar does it a little differently in that some of it is made to order, the certain items that don't have to be prepared far in advance, like, you know, chicken masala or something like that. The chicken is being prepared in advance, but they do a chicken vindaloo, a goat curry, and a shrimp masala. And I got to tell you, that shrimp masala is, you just fucking, you want to kill somebody for it. It's so good. So a lot of bad Indian buffets out there, but Sitar India in Philly, it's a little pricier than usual. A lot of these Indian buffets, you're in and out for $10. And I think Sitar is somewhere like closer to 15, but you can taste it in the quality. And I am a big fan. And I don't know, again, if I'll ever be able to go there, but I am craving some Indian food. Jeff, are you a fan of Indian food at all?
Well, as I've mentioned many times on all 135 episodes of Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdren and Barry, Mrs. Bowdren, not one of the people that's with right. the exotic taste. I have, before my illness, wanted to venture out for some Thai, some, you know, Vietnamese, that kind of stuff. Yeah. And I would probably try Indian food just to, you know, see how I like it. I know it can be very spicy. But now, kind of sidetrack the topic here, Barry. If you're going on your, you know, I'm not talking Scoville, the Grim Reaper, or Carolina Death, whatever those different things are. But if you're going for a hot food, what kind of food do you think is the hottest? Is it Indian? Is it Thai? What do you think?
It's not going to be Indian. The hottest food for me is either going to be Thai food, which, again, I've told that story a half dozen times. Thai food, depending on what you get. Vietnamese food, depending on what you get. But Chinese food can be really, really spicy. And we talked last week about the new Woey Goey Lowey. Lou, have you ordered from there yet?
Not yet. It's on.
All right.
Come on, Lou. Work with us, man.
I'm putting it on the lineup. I'm going to check it out sometime soon.
Yeah, it was funny. After we recorded that last episode, Lou actually sent us a message via Facebook. And I think it was like the Yelp review was something about the restaurant. So I was thrilled to see that. But
yeah,
that
it was their website. You could,
it was their website. Okay.
You can order online right now. I don't know if they ship to Ambler, but who knows?
I will order right now and ship to Tucker, Georgia, if Jeff is ready for it.
Who the fuck lives in Tucker, Georgia?
Where do you live? Don't you live
Cumming.
In Tucker? Cumming. But it was a Tucker Lane. Is that it?
No. You screwed that. You screwed that completely.
Continue. Did I fuck that totally up? But continue. We're not going to edit that. But yeah, it's wherever you are, Jeff, in Georgia. I would ship you. I want to ship you something quality. So food is on my item. But Lou, you do have to try it. And when you do try it, give us some photos. But I want to get Lou's opinion. I'm going to say if Chinese is probably, depending on the type of Chinese food, that's probably the spiciest foods I've ever had. And there are certain types of Mexican foods that I've had based off of the peppers that could be equally as spicy. Lou, what sayeth you?
Well, from my own personal interactions with the various foods, I got to say, I have to make a case for Indian, because around the time, maybe about 8 to 10 years ago, when the food trucks started popping up all over the place, there is a Indian truck called Curry Up Now. And one of their signature dishes was a...
Not a paid endorsement, by the way.
Nope. Not, not yet, anyway. Right. We'll find out. Anyway, their signature food truck dish was a burrito with chicken tikka masala in it. And garbanzo beans and various other toppings. But they say, on their menu, it said... As for mild, medium, or spicy, spicy is boot jalokia. And to me, I'm like, okay, I don't speak Hindi. I have no idea what that means. So I asked for it spicy and took a bite and nearly blew my cranium apart. Boot jalokia is what they call the ghost pepper. And my God, that was something else.
So you have tried ghost pepper?
Indeed, I have. Uh-huh. And live to tell the tale.
When we began talking about it, I mentioned, I'm not talking, you know, Barry, do you ever see that show? It used to be on the Travel Channel. It's on a different channel now with Man versus Food.
Oh, yeah.
And the guy they switched out of Adam Richman and they got another guy. And, you know, he goes in there and he takes these challenges and it's like, oh, it's like, you know, 6 million on the Scoville scale. And he basically is like, you know, he's giving himself a coronary, but, you know, before he's 40. That's not what I'm talking about. Food that's generally hot,
right?
You know, on a regular basis, not something that, you know, you do this like Lou did with the ghost pepper or maybe didn't know. And you specifically do that just to see if you can stand it. Because to me, that's just seeing whether or not you can take it. It's not enhancing the flavor. Would that be fair?
Yeah. So, there's a big difference between. Watching like the Man versus Food. And I remember watching one and he was doing something with chicken wings and the guy had to put on a face mask and gloves because he couldn't touch it if he was breathing in the fumes. And so that's at a different level. You're just looking for a cuisine that might be the spiciest. And yeah, I think it would be Chinese based off what I had. For Lou, it's probably going to be Indian.
Okay. So since I am not so ADD that I remember all these different buffets that I've been to. I'm going to talk in general terms about buffet when you're done with your top five. So why don't you give us your number four, Bear?
My number four absolutely is an area, Jeff, that you were in not too long ago. It's the Pigeon Forge Gatlinburg area.
Well, there you go.
Yes, sir. And I don't know if you went to Dollywood's Dreammore Resort. Very nice hotel, and it's a resort. But she's got a restaurant. The company's got a restaurant there called Song and Hearth, a Southern Eatery. And we had, probably within a year of that place opening up, we went to the breakfast buffet. So it's a beautiful restaurant. It's like an old country cabin. It's obviously not in a cabin, but the way that it's decorated, but it's very clean. It's got this really country vibe. And it's not cheap, but the quality of food for a breakfast buffet, which this was my only breakfast buffet on the list, was really good. They did all the standards. You had an omelet station, the guy doing that, all the breakfast meats. They had like two kinds of ham, which I remember. They had a country ham, and then they had like a smoked sugary brown sugar ham that was fucking to kill for. But what they were doing, which I thought was super cool, was they were making waffles. They had a waffle station and then putting a chicken breast, a bone-in chicken breast, right on top and then topping that with maple syrup. And I guess it was fresh maple syrup. And that was off the charts. It was phenomenal. So, you know, eggs are eggs for the most part. I don't know how different that's going to be. The fruit selection was great, but it was that chicken and waffles. And it's all you can eat. I only ate one. I couldn't eat any more, but this was a step above the average breakfast buffet. And that fucking ham, Jeff, I know you're a country ham guy. This ham with this brown sugar and smokiness, oh my God, I'm starving right now.
Well, you know, here's the thing about buffets in general, is you go down there, and this is one of the things I used to find. You drop, let's just say it's 10, 11 bucks a person, okay? And you sit there, and you're like, you start looking at, and of course, we're talking about going to a nice breakfast buffet, not a, you know, Golden Corral kind of place. And you're looking, and as you look, you're like, oh, yeah, that looks pretty tasty. Well, I don't want to pass that up either. And what ends up happening is you get a little bit of a lot of things. And at the end, you sit there and go, did I really get $11 worth of food there?
Yep.
You know, and that's my primary complaint.
So, well, Jeff, what I like about your complaint is that it leads me into number three, where it's high on my list because I got my value on this one. So about, Zach is 19, about 7 years ago, maybe 8 years ago, the family decided to go to Williamsburg, Virginia, to the Great Wolf Lodge and spend New Year's Eve there. And they were doing the kids love going and probably still would love going there. We haven't been the last few years. They love going to the Great Wolf Lodge. You're familiar with the Great Wolf Lodge, Jeff?
I don't believe I am.
So it's a lodge, it's a hotel, it's a resort that also has a massive indoor water park. So you can go to the water park. You have to be a registered guest of the lodge. It's included in the cost of the room, but it's great, especially if you've got kids. The water inside, it's always the same temperature. When we were there, it was a blizzard taking place outside, and you can see the snow, and you're in riding the rides in the water park. So it's super fucking cool. But they also, being that it was New Year's Eve, they had a dinner buffet, and I want to say it was like $30, maybe $35 per person for an adult. Kids were like $14.95, and it was all you can eat. And the two featured items they had were hand-carved prime rib and all-you-can-eat snow crab legs. Are you a fan of snow crab?
I am not.
I can fucking eat 80 pounds. I could eat my body weight in snow crab. I could eat lose body weight in snow crab.
Now, wait a minute.
Hold on there. Wait a minute. So when I saw that, I said to my son, I was like, well, we got to go and hang out for at least an hour. We sat there and we ate so much to the point that we couldn't eat anymore. And I got, for again, $30 or $35, I must have eaten $100 worth of snow crab legs. So it was the perceived value of how much I was spending. Got to say, snow crab is pretty much snow crab. If I get it in Virginia, I get it in PA or Florida, it's all going to taste the same. It's a frozen product. They thaw it out. They serve it with drawn butter. But man, do I love it. So I ate so much. And for $35, I don't think I even ate breakfast the next day. I was so full. It worked out. Lou, are you a fan of snow crab?
I'm a fan of just about any type of crab. Being a San Franciscan, Dungeness is what, yes, I'm partial to. But snow crab, Alaskan king crab, my God. Yeah, just about any of that crustacean.
And of course, Barry, I know you probably grew up on Joe's stone crabs in South Florida.
I did, and that's actually going to lead up to number two for me, Jeff, on my list.
Nothing like a nice transition, my man.
And that's what we're doing with, which is beautiful. So years ago, this is going back to, I think, 1982, I was working at a restaurant in Miami Beach, and the manager of the restaurant had to go to West Palm Beach for business. He didn't have a license. He didn't drive. And he said, I will pay you to drive me to West Palm Beach and I will buy you lunch at the Breakers in West Palm Beach. I didn't know what the Breakers was. And I said, so I think he was giving me $50, which was a lot of money back then. So I said, fuck yeah, I'll do it. I think it was $100 and I absolutely did it. But he took me to lunch at the Breakers in West Palm Beach. And the Breakers is a real, I think they're scattered throughout the U.S. now, or at least the South. But this was
suffice to say, they're very upscale.
They really are upscale.
They're like the Breakers. Yeah.
Yeah. They're super upscale. I definitely didn't fit in here. I can tell you that. But it's a buffet. I forget what the cost was because I didn't pay. On the buffet was stone crab claws that you just mentioned with Joe Stone Crab, jumbo shrimp, almost prawn like, and lobster tail. And it was all you can eat. So again, I grab, fuck like chicken fingers and mac and cheese. You're right over where like the shellfish is and these high priced items are. And I sat there and I just stuffed my face. But I am a gigantic fan of stone crab claws. And Lou just mentioned Dungeness crab, which is, I think it's indigenous to the San Francisco and Northern California. When you walk along the piers of San Francisco, there are signs that says it's illegal to take Dungeness crab from this water, which I just thought, I even got a photo of that the last time I was out there. I thought that was so cool. I'm with you, the Lou. There's no such thing as a bad style of crab. There are certain crab that I like better, but I will eat any crab at any time.
All right. So now that leaves you one. What's your number one?
My number one, Jeff. So this holds a very special place in my heart. And I will tell you this, as we're actually approaching Father's Day, which is probably less than 2 months away, maybe a month and a half away, the best Father's Day I think I ever spent was Father's Day 2005. My daughter was, I guess, about 8 months old, maybe 9 months old. Zach was 4 years old, and it was my day off. I was working at Universal Studios, and we decided to spend the day at the Animal Kingdom Lodge at Disney World. It was just, I have photos of this day. It was so a wonderful day. We snuck into the pool. We spent the day by the pool. My wife and I had cocktails by the pool. The weather was perfect. We looked at the animals, which are all a part of the Animal Kingdom Lodge. We hit the video game room. And then for dinner, it was Father's Day dinner. We went to Boma, which is an African-themed buffet. It's called Boma Flavors of Africa. No Ethiopian food, though, Jeff, I'm happy to say. But the rest of the food was great. And I continued to go back. I haven't been there, I think, in 5 or 6 years was the last time I went to Disney World. And we stayed at the Animal Kingdom Lodge. But they do this lamb stew. I know you like lamb. And partly, they do this lamb stew that's fantastic. The best roasted chicken I've ever had. They do something called a Durban-style roasted chicken. And it's got this African spice over it. And then they slow cook it. They do spice-crusted beef. They do something called bobotai. And it's a South African dish. And it's basically spiced meat baked with like an egg topping. But it's almost like shepherd's pie if you're removing the mashed potatoes and you're putting like an egg topping on it. I know it sounds a little funky, but it's fantastic. But where they knock it out of the park is the fucking desserts there. They do the zebra domes, and they're like a Kahlua-based zebra dome. It's black and white with this Kahlua-based mousse in the center of it. It is fucking killer. They do Kenyan coffee tarts, an African apple spice cake, coconut mango chocolate tart. It's phenomenal. So I have so many good memories on a personal level, but I love the food there. And it's, you know, everything's exciting. The flavors are vibrant. It's not cheap. It's probably $50 a person, which is, you know, super pricey. But whenever I am spending a few days in Orlando, this is the one restaurant that I always try to get to. It's my favorite buffet ever. I don't know if I'll ever be going again, at least for the next few years, obviously, but just fantastic. You are a fan of lamb, though, right?
Yes. And as you were talking, I suddenly remembered what my favorite all-time buffet was.
There you go.
There you go. Upon the year of our betrothal, is that a word? The year we got married, Mrs. Bowder and I went out to Vegas, stayed at Caesars, but we went and had, we hit the breakfast buffets a couple places. Mandalay Bay. Have you ever been to Mandalay Bay in Vegas?
I have. Yes.
I thought their breakfast buffet was absolutely superior. Your thoughts? Not even breakfast buffet, just buffet in general, because they literally rotate that thing about 18 hours a day.
Yeah, well, they definitely have to. So I was just in Vegas a couple of months ago and I stayed at Caesars and they have a seafood buffet and I didn't go just because the lines were fucking out of control. I don't know if I ever ate a buffet at Mandalay Bay. I know that I didn't. I don't know if I've ever, I did have a buffet in Vegas years ago, but I don't know. So how was your honeymoon at Caesar's Palace?
We had a great time. We took a helicopter tour of the Grand Canyon, went down in there. It was a good time. And just hotter than the sun though, you know, cause we went like in, we saved money cause we went in August or something. But no, very nice. That's like one of those places where you should go to once at least, because it's a lot of fun. We're not into the area called Red Rocks and yep. Drove out in the mountains and stuff like that. It was a very good time. So the buffets that Barry has mentioned, the Mandalay Bay, as well as probably Caesar's Palace, probably a bit upscale over your Golden Corral or your Shoney's, I'm going to guess, Barry.
Yeah, they are. And that's not to knock, because people rave about Shoney's Breakfast Buffet and the Golden Corral. You know, apparently there, and this is a funny story, there is an offshoot of the Golden Corral, and I want to say it's called Platinum Corral, and it's a higher-end restaurant. This was 10 or 12 years ago, and I saw the email, they were trying to recruit the executive chef of the restaurant that I was working in. So he showed me the email, and neither of us had ever heard about Platinum Corral before, but a lot of people love it. But there's a good point right there. What about restaurants that sustain on just doing buffets like the Golden Corral or Duff's? What's going to happen to these? You know, are they going to have to close permanently, or is this going to be a complete menu revamp?
Well, and you know, one of the places that we haven't been to in a while, but you know, we've discussed in the past about places that have kind of revamped themselves, is Ruby Tuesdays used to be really well known.
Oh yeah,
for their salad bar and their buffet and stuff like that, and places that's an integral part of the whole appeal of the restaurant. You have to wonder what's going to happen.
Yeah, it's a big thing. I think Ruby Tuesday can somehow survive the loss of the salad bar, and I'm not sure what they're going to do. So if you were saying to me, and just, you know, off the top of my head, what would I do in place of the salad bar, is I would bring out, obviously, two salads. It's a table of two. I would bring out a salad for each individual, but maybe I would bring out a plate of some of the items that used to be on the salad bar. So you'd go in the kitchen and say, hey, I need an appetizer plate. And they put together, you know, maybe five of the most popular items that used to be on it. And then the couple shares it. That's just off the top of my head. But you're right. A company like Ruby Tuesday is going to have to revamp, because they've been known for 40 years on doing that salad bar. So that is going to be a big deal. I think hotel restaurants, and hotels are known for doing buffets, especially during holidays like Mother's Day and things like that, they can revamp. But I think if you've got a chain like Golden Corral and Sweet Lou checking in, obviously, once you reach platinum status, don't you think it should cease to be called a corral? Yeah, it should. Absolutely. Even Golden, I don't know. Corral is where horses shit. So why would you want to eat there? That's a whole nother topic right there. And Lou brings up a great point. Why would you name your restaurant after a place that horses are shitting?
It's a very good question. It's a good question. You know, I mean,
years ago, there was a chain for women, and it was women who were going to buy dresses, and it was called Dress Barn. Is that really where the average woman wants to go shopping, at a place called The Barn?
Well, is it still in existence?
I don't know.
Apparently not, then.
There you go. So, Sweet Lou, we've been talking about buffets. Jeff just gave us his favorite buffet. Yeah. I rattled off a few of mine. How about you? Any memorable buffet experiences?
Oh, yeah. Almost exclusively, the best buffets I've had have been in Las Vegas, and they've been kind of the Tony ones. Steve Wynn is a casino magnate. You can always guarantee that any spots he's owned, they've had top flight buffets. So I started, you know, when he owned the Bellagio, that was an awesome buffet. Now at the Wynn, the buffet there is pretty mind blowing in quality. A pretty penny, but still fairly insane. As far as sort of with contemporary cuisine, at City Center, the resort called The Cosmopolitan, they have a buffet called Wicked Spoon. And that's a relatively new and great place to be. As far as like everyday sort of buffets and stuff, there was a chain called Fresh Choice that was out here on the West Coast. They kind of faded out over the past few years, but I thought they had really good selections of salad soups.
You know, we haven't even mentioned how many Chinese restaurants are out there that a buffet is a central part of their appeal, you know?
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. And then how about the business model of, like, say, Sizzler?
Yep.
Sizzler, where it's the steaks and the meats are all right and stuff, but it mainly revolves around a salad bar, which last I went, it was, to call it mediocre would be a superlative.
And, you know, one of the other things is, think about, we're not talking specifically buffet here, but just like the self-serve industry at a local store.
Done.
Mrs. Baldwin.
Lorenz.
Done. Salad bars where you serve yourself. New York City, you can walk into any convenience store, which is a bodega, and there is beautiful salad bars where you serve yourself. And I avoided them for the simple reason that, you know, you can look at TMZ on a weekly basis and they've got some video of some jagoff going in there, you know, putting his feet like in the fucking, you know, macaroni and cheese or something. So I avoid it. But those businesses were sustaining on that. So you're looking at a complete overhaul of their business model. Yeah. Holy shit.
Slurpees. I can't get a friggin' Slurpee anymore, Barry.
Really? Yeah. I didn't know that.
I mean, you go into like a 7-Eleven or a, you know, racetrack, one of these other national gas station chains, and you go to get a soda or some sort of Slurpee or Icy. Nope. Can't do it anymore.
Wow. I didn't even know that.
So, and you think about the effect that has on their business.
Yeah.
You know, absolutely. It's just like a sort of a trickle down effect. So anyway, all right, gentlemen, I think we've touched on our buffet topic. By the way, I did want to mention Mrs. Bowdern had to walk in. We have a local buffet here called Loretta's that serves a wicked breakfast buffet that Mrs. Bowdern and I had been to in the past, hope to return to, but yeah, like we said, probably not. Barry, yet another successful episode in the books. We learned a little bit. I certainly learned a little. I learned a lot about Montreal wrestling. And we're going to have part two of our interview with Pat LaPrade next week, as Pat LaPrade will take us into a little something that was recently in the news about the dark side of the ring as we discussed Dino Bravo.
Yeah. So how good was Pat, Jeff? We've really had some amazing guests on here. We've had, obviously, George Shire did two episodes with us discussing the AWA. And, you know, you go back to our wrestling. Jimmy Garvin got us a lot of attention, but we've had some amazing talent on here. But listening to Pat, I was hanging on every single word. What a fountain of knowledge he is.
Yeah, this is really, really good stuff. And I hope you will tune in for part two, because we're also going to be discussing his forthcoming book on Andre the Giant. Everybody likes a good Andre the Giant story. I like the fact that you pulled Tarzan Tyler out of there, Barry. That was, you know, it was a guy that when I first started watching wrestling, he was part of the WWF champions, tag team championship with Crazy Luke Graham, which, yeah, the very first tag team champions that Captain Lou Albano ever represented.
I remember seeing that photo. I think that was a George Napolitano photo. Yeah. George Napolitano, who... back in the old days, too. So, you know, again, so much of our listenership is young, thank God. But, you know, if you've got a photo, you can get online and you can watermark it. Well, back in those days, we didn't even have access to a computer. So George Napolitano somehow did get backstage access to the WWF, but he would take photos and then he would hand write a copyright symbol, the C in a circle, with his name on every photo. And if you bought a photo from him, he would actually do that. He would actually, you were buying a photo that he had written on, which is kind of funky in hindsight. But Tarzan Tyler, Jeff, real interesting character and a guy that you may have seen in Georgia as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So anyway, so we would encourage you to come back for part two of our interview with Pat LaPrade. And we, of course, will, we have a match of the week that we're going to have next week that involves Montreal. Yes. And Pat is going to actually sit with us and talk about the match of the week for Montreal. So, and okay, I'm going to do this. I'm going to throw this out for a couple of certain listeners. I'm just going to give a little tease, Barry.
Okay.
It involves the Road Warriors. Boom. There we go. Now we've got an increased audience because, yes, Bowdern the Booker is going to sit back and talk about the Road Warriors next week. So I would encourage you to check out part two of our interview with Pat LaPrade next week here on Breaking KFA with Bowdern and Barry. We are a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. Our man, sweet Lou Kippelman, on the production duties. Thank you, Lou. And until next week, Barry, bonsoir. Is it bonsoir or bonjour?